What happens when you find out your great-great-grandma is a ghost?
Julia is so subject to interpretation. She's this historical hole. So people have filled it with their own interpretations. And from the ghost stories, you know, the ghost stories range from, first she was just this pioneer, and then she became this ghost, and then she was an abused wife. She was chained to the radiator. She was mentally ill. She killed herself. She was murdered. She hung herself from the chandelier. She was addicted to laudanum. There's all these stories.
That's Hannah Nordhaus. Her wonderful history/memoir of her ancestor Julia Staub is called American Ghost. And if apple pie is a symbol of America, apples may be a symbol of New England.
It's really astonishing to me as I look back that the first record of apples in New England dates back to 1623, only 3 years after the Mayflower. And I think that points to the importance of apples, not just as a food, but as a symbol of the landscape from which the Europeans came.
That's Russell Stephen Powell. We talk with him about his book, Apples of New England, A User's Guide. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When author Hannah Nordhaus was growing up, she heard vague stories about her great-great-grandmother, Julia Staub, who came to the American Southwest in 1866 as a young Jewish bride from a small town in Germany. But then Nordhaus came across some very puzzling accounts that claimed her ancestor was haunting a fancy hotel in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Part of the hotel was once Julia Staub's home, built for her by her husband, a wealthy businessman and political mover and shaker on the southwest frontier. Nordhaus's journey to discover the truth about her great-great-grandmother led her down some very unusual paths, not only into dusty historical archives, but also to the doorsteps of psychics. The more she dug into her family's secrets, the stronger their mysteries became. In the process, Nordhaus ended up learning some important lessons about herself as well. The result is her book, American Ghost. It's a fascinating story of immigration, the settling of the West, and of how a German bride became an American woman and then an American legend. Hannah Nordhaus is an award-winning journalist and author of The Beekeeper's Lament. American Ghost is her second book. Well, Hannah Nordhaus, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
This wonderful book, American Ghost, is about your great-great-grandmother, Julia, who came to the Southwest as a young bride from Germany. What had you heard about Julia while you were growing up?
Well, I had known about Julia Staub for my entire life, and mostly just that she was a pioneer who had come to Santa Fe with her husband, and they had built what had been a dusty frontier town into the modern American city that it is. And that was about all I knew about her when I was a child.
And you had heard enough stories about her?
Had I heard ghost stories? I had not heard any ghost stories about her until I was a teenager. It was probably in the early 1980s when suddenly my relatives from New Mexico, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and my New Mexico relatives started sending us clippings from the newspapers about Julia's ghost and that she was reputed to haunt La Posada Hotel, which is the hotel that occupies the site, the former home that Julia and Abraham built in the 1880s.
Tell us about the world that Julia came from, and then tell us about the world she came into. But first start with where she grew up in Germany.
She grew up in Westphalia, which is it's northwestern Germany, and she came from a little village called Luchta, which is the closest big city is Hanover. And I visited the village when I was doing my research, and it's a lovely little village along a river with lots of fachwerk homes, which are the frame and timber homes. And so it was quite a small village, and she was one of, I think, depending on which family tree you look at, 11 or 12 siblings, and had lots of cousins there too. So it was a quite intimate place that she came from, and in the countryside, it was a really beautiful place. And at the age of 21, she married Abraham Staub, my great-great-grandfather, who also came from Luchta, from the same village. And very quickly, they married on Christmas Day, 1866. And by January 9th, she was in New York. So it was a real quick transition. And then she got on a stagecoach and traveled the Santa Fe Trail. She took a boat and a train to Kansas City, which was the end of the Santa Fe Trail at that point, or the end of the line, the railroad line. And from there, she went by stagecoach along the Santa Fe Trail across the plains and over the mountains to Santa Fe. And Santa Fe at the time was a really wild place. It was gunfights every night, gambling on the streets, lots of prostitution. It was really a frontier town and a place in flux from having been sort of a quiet, sleepy Spanish and then Mexican city to being the end of this trade route from the States, as they called it, from the East to the Southwest.
She must have been in real culture shock.
I can only imagine coming from this really green and beautiful and bucolic place in Germany and then getting on the trails and going by horseback to across the Santa Fe Trail, which was even in those days when it wasn't, she only had to travel 700 miles, I think, along the Santa Fe Trail versus her husband, Abraham, when he came in the 1850s, would have had to go all the way from St. Louis. So it was a much longer trip and he would have gone by wagon and now there was a stagecoach route. But nonetheless, it was a really, it was midwinter when she traveled and it must have just been incredibly stark and cold and rutted and bumpy, and she traveled the trail and then arrived in this city that Santa Fe at the time, and it's a beautiful place now, and at the time it's beautiful, the mountains there and the sky, but there were no trees there at the time or very few, and it really was just it was really the dusty wild frontier, and it must have just, and she didn't speak English, she didn't speak Spanish, so I think she must have felt very isolated.
I think most of us really don't really think about Jews in the Wild West. What was it like for a Jew to be in that kind of pioneer environment?
Well, I think it was very hard to be an observant Jew in New Mexico in the 1860s. There's of course this history of the crypto Jews who were the conversos who were kicked out from Spain during the Spanish Inquisition. And so there was some Jewish heritage in New Mexico, but a lot of these people didn't even realize they were Jewish at the time that Julia and Abraham arrived from Germany. And the Jewish community in Santa Fe, when Abraham Staub arrived, consisted of basically of his cousins, the Spiegelberg family, who had come from a nearby village and then had brought him over to work for them. So there was sort of this chain migration of these Jews from northwestern Germany, and there was probably a handful of them when Julia arrived. And so there was no temple, there was no place to observe. And they did keep some traditions, and there was I write in the book, there was a traveling rabbi who came and performed circumcisions for them, but quite late, when the boys were quite old. So it was really sort of catch as catch can kind of tradition, and the shops, most of the shops were open on Saturdays. Sometimes they'd close for Jewish holidays, but it was they just sort of did what they needed to survive, and you couldn't really be in an enclave among your own religion there. So they assimilated pretty quickly.
Germany was not the most friendly place for a Jew even then. Was it more friendly for Jews in the Southwest? Was it just because it was a pioneer environment that anybody was accepted?
I think so, yes. I think, and this may sound a little insensitive, but I think as long as they were white, then they were accepted. And obviously, New Mexico was in this process of transitioning from being a Spanish and Mexican place to being an American place. And very quickly, this Anglo governing structure formed and sort of high society. And So the Jews in Santa Fe, they didn't keep to themselves. They definitely hung out with each other, but they spent a lot of time with non-Jews, much more than they would have in a place like New York, because there just weren't enough Jews to go around. And I think the same was true of other Anglos. So they became very quickly integrated into the larger white society. And you don't see, I went through tons and tons of newspapers to find out about what they did and where they went. And there were tons of parties, and there was rarely a Hispanic name at any of the parties that they went to. But there was all sorts of Jews and Gentiles together at all these events.
Now, Abraham was quite successful there. In fact, he was quite the operator, both on a political level and a business level. Tell us a little bit about that before we get into the heart of this American ghost story, Hannah Nordhaus.
So Abraham Staub came to New Mexico in the 1850s, and depending on which account you read, he either came in 1854, 1856, or 1858, and he came to work for his cousins, the Spiegelberg brothers, who were the first German Jews who had gotten to Santa Fe. And the oldest Spiegelberg, Solomon, had come with the conquering army, the General Doniphan's army, as they conquered Santa Fe, and he had been a sutler, which is a supply, sort of merchant supplier to the troops. So he came with the troops. He ended up staying there. He brought four brothers over, and then they also brought Abraham, who was their first cousin, and his brother Zadok. And suit Abraham and Zadok worked for the Spiegelbergs for a while, and then spun off their own company and became quite wealthy pretty quickly, in part by supplying the U.S. troops during the Civil War. There was actually a Civil War battle very close to Santa Fe, and for a time the Confederate Army had taken over Santa Fe. So they supplied the Union troops. They picked the right side in that battle and got quite wealthy. And then he, right after the war ended, he became a U.S. citizen and then went back to fetch his bride, who was Julia Staub. And he only got richer from there. He made a lot of money. By the time he died, he was considered the richest man in New Mexico, and doing dry goods trade, the wagon trains along the Santa Fe Trail, but also he invested in real estate. He sort of had his hand in everything in Santa Fe. He was a man about town.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist and author Hannah Nordhaus about her latest book, American Ghost, A Family's Haunted Past in the Desert Southwest. Now, of course, the story really centers on your great-great-grandmother. Others have been fascinated by her story. There is a ghost involved here. I mean, obviously that's the center of the story, but I don't want to give things away that you don't want to give away. So tell us what you want to about your grandmother and the fascination, the stories that grew up around her as a ghost.
So as I mentioned, she wasn't a ghost that anybody knew of until the late 1970s, early 80s. That's the first account you find about her ghost in the local newspapers. And the stories sort of grew from there, and everything like lights dimming, chandeliers swinging. There's a story, one of my favorite stories is my cousin told me that she was friends with the bartenders that their house is now this quite nice hotel, La Posada in Santa Fe. And the hotel is built around the original house. So the house is sort of wrapped in adobe now. And the original living area, downstairs living area, is now this bar called the Staub House Bar. And then there's a few sitting rooms around there. So the locus of this ghostly activity is supposed to be around in the bar and then upstairs where Julia's room was, which is the room where she died. And my cousin was friends with some bartenders there, and they said that at one time a new bride walked into the bar and all these glasses started being thrown at her, from nowhere. And Julia's also, her ghost is also said to, tip over people's trays of glasses. And one thing that apparently she likes to do a lot is yank the blankets off of sleeping guests. And I actually just did a book signing at La Posada last week, and people showed up with all sorts of stories. I had like goosebumps the entire time because people kept coming up to me and telling me their experience with Julia. So she's quite a famous ghost in Santa Fe.
You describe yourself as a rationalist. What was your initial reaction to these stories?
I am a rationalist. I'm not easily persuaded, and I still don't really know what I believe, but my reaction is both, I just love a ghost story. You know, these stories, even if you don't believe them, I get goosebumps every time someone tells me one of these stories. And at the same time, I don't know if I really believe them, and I don't really come out any differently after 3 years of research in writing this book. You just can't know what you don't know. And I did have an experience. The book sort of culminates in me sleeping in Julia's room. And I'm not going to tell you what it was. I'll leave it for your listeners to read the book. But something did happen. And it wasn't, it wasn't like Julia sat down appearing in her full Victorian garb and told me everything about herself. It was certainly not that obvious. But even, you know, I still don't quite know if it really happened. And even if I was 100% certain that it really happened, I just don't think anybody would believe me who wasn't inclined to believe me in the first place. And so that's where you sort of get with ghost stories. People just believe whatever they want to believe. And that's fine. You can still enjoy the stories, which I very much do.
It's so interesting that you say you don't know if it really happened, although it happened to you.
One thing I realized in researching this book was that that's true of life. It's not just ghost stories. Ghost stories are more obvious because people are talking about voices and visions from the beyond, and we don't know what happens after death. But even in the telling of history, there are all these unknowns, and science too. My last book was called The Beekeeper's Lament. It was about a beekeeper and about the bee crisis, the honeybees, and the recent deaths. And there's tons of hard science around that, but we still don't there's all these mysteries still. We still don't know the answers, and a lot of the answers are interpreted to how we want to believe them. And so, I mean, one of the things that this book really opened my eyes to is that even the hard facts of history are often kind of fuzzy, and a lot of my family history stories that I thought were true turn out to be, in a way, to be their own kind of ghost stories. There's a lot of apocrypha around my family history, and it's hard to find the truth. You know, I'd try to find citizenship documents, and just even, as I mentioned, the date when my great-great-grandfather Abraham came to America, I found like 5 different dates, and these were on passport declarations. So the truth is just a really elusive thing in history and in ghost stories.
Yes, you write that ghost hunting and ancestor hunting is not that far apart, and that the more you dug, the less you knew. Is that what you're talking about here?
Exactly, yeah. So one of our family stories, this preceded the ghost stories, was that Abraham Staub had helped finance the construction of Santa Fe's Cathedral, which is, it's a, you know, beautiful little Romanesque building, or not, a pretty big Romanesque building in downtown Santa Fe that was built by Archbishop Jean-Baptiste Lamy, or Lamy, as they say, in New Mexico. And he ran out of money when he was building the cathedral, and it took a really long time to build. And the story has always been, and you'll hear the tour guides will tell the story, you read it in the history books, that Abraham, Julia's husband, lent the Archbishop the money, gave him the money to finish the cathedral. So they joke, the tour guides joke, that it's Catholic on the bottom and Jewish on top. And I always had believed that story to be true. And when I started digging around, it became clear there's no documentation of it. And there's a rabbi named Floyd Fearman who insists that there's no way it could be true. He found no documentation in any of the archbishop's papers with his mentor in Cincinnati. And it turns out on the archway of the cathedral, there's something called a tetragrammaton, which is, it's 4 Hebrew letters that spell Yahweh. And the story goes that Abraham told the archbishop that he would give him the money for the cathedral, and the only thing he asked in exchange were these Hebrew letters on top. So that's why they say it's Catholic on the bottom, Jewish on top. But in fact, Rabbi Fearman realized that this tetragrammaton is quite common in Europe. And I found out in my research that there was actually a tetragrammaton on the cathedral in Luchta, in the town where Julia and Abraham came from. So all these things that we think are true, when you dig down, it gets more and more confusing. I felt like I was just being driven around in circles.
Well, when you started out, you really didn't know that much about your great-great-grandmother, Julia, Hannah Nordhaus. In the book American Ghost, it's almost as if the picture is becoming clearer and clearer, almost like a photograph does as it's being developed. I wonder what it was like, that process was like for you. How was the process of getting a deeper sense of who your grandmother was? And it seems at the end you find out, you really get a sense of what her feelings, what her emotions, what her psychology, what was really going on with her.
So it was a very consuming process. I felt more and more drawn into her world, and it was really fun. I am trained as a historian, and I just love this kind of research. So every time I, you know, find their name in a newspaper article or something, I just get this incredible thrill. And at some point, a few months into it, I found a diary of my great-grandmother Bertha's, which we thought had been lost. And that was just so exciting to find it. And then when I started reading it, I just felt, you know, she was 21 years old. It was not always the most illuminating document. It was a lot about, like, the different boys she met or young gentlemen she met. But it gave me such a sense of their world and what it was like to be a 21-year-old Jewish girl from New Mexico traveling the world with her family. And I just, you know, I felt like I was there at times. And then when I went to Germany and traced the steps that, it was a travel diary. It started in California, and then they went to Germany, and they were trying to get Julia better because she'd been very ill. And they went to all these different spas. And so my mother and I went to Germany and traced their steps. And I just, you know, there were times, and these same buildings, the same hotels are there. And there were times I just felt like I was in their world collecting silver spoons and wearing a, you know, high-necked Victorian dress. And it was really, really quite a, you know, I would dream about them at night. It was quite a consuming process. And I just learned so much. I felt so lucky to be able to dig into this. And so the other thing is, the research I did, I could not have done 10 years ago. The internet has made this so much easier. I mean, all the newspapers, I was able to search by the name Staub. I couldn't have done that 10 years ago. And I found so much information that would have just flown under the radar. So it really, I just felt really fortunate to be able to dig in the way I did.
Now, you consulted psychics. Any of them that hit the mark?
Well, they all hit the marks in different ways. There's a couple that were really just completely off. But for the most part, they all had a few little details that seemed to ring true. And again, I'm a rationalist. I'm pretty skeptical. I provided them some information up front. I said, I'm trying to connect with my great-great-grandmother's ghost who's supposed to haunt a hotel in Santa Fe. And so they knew that she was probably a 19th century woman. And so they had some stuff to go on. And so there were some commonalities. And they talked a lot about how she loved flowers. That was something all of them said. Where's one who mentioned she had lost her last her eighth child. She had seven children who survived to adulthood, and she lost one as an infant, her last one. And there's one who mentioned that she'd lost a child. There was a lot of talk about her relationship with her husband, Abraham. So, and I met with one psychic in the hotel, in the library below Julia's room, and, you know, everything she said rang true, but we were sort of, you know, she knew more about her. We were in her environment. So the way I sort of ended up thinking about the psychics was that, you know, in general, I found there's so little documentary evidence about Julia. There was, you know, I had the diary, I had some newspaper articles, but there was nothing like, you know, she wrote. There, people didn't talk about her a lot. So I really had to find her through the stories of others. And what the psychics did in some way was to sort of flesh out the skeleton of her story. And it may not have been true, but it gave me a sense of her, you know, that she liked flowers, that she had once loved another man besides her husband, that she lived for her children, that she, at the end of her life, she just rocked back and forth in the rocking chair in her room. And even though, you know, I have no idea whether anything they said was true, they in some ways helped me make her real by filling in those gaps in her story that were missing in the sort of the hard documentary evidence.
It's almost as if you wrote in a number of different genres, and as you're talking here, it makes me think that you were doing history, and you're also doing memoir because you're involved in this story as well. And in some ways, you're writing fiction because you can only you know, you can try to channel Julia, but you can't be her, and she didn't express herself for herself. What are your thoughts on those different genres and giving the proper balance to each?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. It really, and it was hard to write for that reason. It really skips around from genre to genre. You know, I think I thought it was going to be a lot more of a just straight, hard history when I started writing the book. And but I knew I'd be playing with all these gaps. I knew that she was a 19th century woman who wasn't famous in any way. So there was only so much I was going to find about her. So I knew I'd have to sort of dance around this basic like hole, this absence, even though she's a presence as a ghost. Like she's this great absence historically. So the history stuff was easy for me and fun, and I could have done it forever. And that was, reading the newspaper articles, the diary, all the history books, other people's primary documents and journals from the Santa Fe Trail and from early Santa Fe, and the Jewish history in Germany. And that stuff, it was a lot in terms of, it was sort of epic in scope, but I know how to deal with history. The memoir stuff was a lot harder for me. I'm not particularly, what's the word? I'm not an exhibitionist emotionally or physically in any way. And it's really hard for me to tell my story. And as you said about, in some ways I was making myself a character of my own book. And that was a real struggle for me. And every time someone would read a draft of it, they'd say, "We need more of you. We need more of you." And I think I might have finally gotten there, I hope, at the end. I'm in there and my motivations and what, and I ended up really learning something from Julia and her life that I hadn't really, again, I went into this as a historian, so I hadn't really thought that there'd be personal lessons in it for me, and there really were. And then in terms of the fictional aspect, Julia is so subject to interpretation. I mean, she's this historical hole. So people have filled it with their own interpretations. And from the ghost stories, the ghost stories range from that first she was just this pioneer, and then she became this ghost, and then she became, she was an abused wife. She was chained to the radiator. She was mentally ill. She killed herself. She was murdered. She hung herself from the chandelier. She was addicted to laudanum. There's all these stories. And what I realized is reading them online, and there was a novel written about her, and I met people who'd had encounters, was that people sort of filled the gaps of her life with their own stories in many ways. And you might say, maybe the psychics were truly clairvoyant, although they often contradicted each other. So they weren't all always on the mark, but they also told a story about Julia's life that was probably largely fictional. So I have, I had to string together all these fictions with the sparse facts of her life and then my own reaction to them. And it was hard. It's really hard.
Well, you did a terrific job. I want to ask you, what were the lessons that you learned? You say at the end of the book that you considered the story of Julia's ghost as a gift.
Yeah, it really was. I guess, the first lesson I learned was that how lucky I am and how lucky we are as to live when we do and to have the opportunities that we have and the support from family and friends to be able to get on a plane to go home. I think Julia felt so yanked out of this wonderful village that she came from in Germany and so displaced. None of her other her brothers came to America. None of her sisters did. So she felt very alone and isolated, and she suffered from depression. And so, I realize how lucky I am to have a resilient constitution and to have grown up in an environment that kept it that way. I know that some of her children suffered from mental illness as well. And while researching this book, and since it's come out, I've talked to a lot of far-flung relatives who were descended from Julia, her siblings. And it sounds like there's a lot of mental illness in the family as a whole. So I feel extremely lucky to be more resilient than Julia was. And I think, at the end of her life, she was a recluse. She was shut up in her room, and it's not clear exactly if it was all mental illness or if she also had some physical debilities as well. But I just, her children, some of her children had a similar constitution to her, and then others just sort of turned around and faced the world and lived as fully as they could. And one of the things I learned is just how important it is to remain engaged with the world and to count our blessings and try as hard as we can to to stay here.
Well, it's a terrific book. The book is American Ghost, and my guest has been Hannah Nordhaus. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really fun to talk to you.
Hannah Nordhaus is the award-winning author of The Beekeeper's Lament. American Ghost is her most recent book. Read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk about apples and their place in the history and culture of New England. Stay tuned.
Some bright morning when this life is over,
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Before the apples of Washington State, there were the apples of New England. Johnny Appleseed himself came from Leominster, Massachusetts, and before him, in fact, almost as soon as the Puritans had touched ground at Plymouth Rock, apple trees were brought to the region from England. My guest, Russell Stephen Powell, is the perfect person to write the story of the New England apple. A writer, visual artist, and a magazine publisher, he's devoted his talents to bringing the unique sense of place of the New England landscape to a larger audience. He was a publisher and editor of New England Watershed, a journal of culture, art, and ideas, and he's executive director of the New England Apple Association. He's written two books on the subject, America's Apple, and his newest, a regional history and guidebook, Apples of New England, out from the Countryman Press. Well, Russell Powell, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
This is just a lovely book, Apples of New England, a user's guide. Why did you write this book?
Well, I feel that apples have a special hold on our imaginations as well as our stomachs. And we have such a rich tradition of growing apples in New England with so many varieties that were discovered here centuries ago but are now forgotten or nearly forgotten. I felt that it was time to bring this history to light.
And in fact, the apple came very early to New England. Talk about the first New England apples and how they arrived here.
It's really astonishing to me as I look back that the first record of apples in New England dates back to 1623, only 3 years after the Mayflower. And I think that points to the importance of apples, not just as a food, but as a symbol of the landscape from which the Europeans came. In England, everybody had their few small apple trees, and I think they really wanted to replicate that model when they came to the New World. And part of that is obviously about food, that at the time, apples were a major source of year-round sweetness, could be distilled into vinegar, could be pressed into cider and fermented into hard cider, and that was available as a drink year-round. So really, 1623 is the beginning, and it was through bringing apple seeds rather than scions to be grafted. We did not have apples here in New England. We had a few native crab apples, and the seeds were going to produce fruit that was not necessarily edible, but at the time, that was not really important. What was important was that you could press any apple, no matter how sour or bitter, into juice, and it would be magically transformed into something sweet and tasty.
So tell us about the Reverend William Blackstone.
He was an odd duck, for sure. He definitely did a lot to promote the apple in the New World and planted an orchard in Boston soon after his arrival. in the 1620s. And from there, he went to Rhode Island. He is credited by some for the first named variety in the U.S. called, William Sweeting, or Blackson Sweeting, I'm sorry. And most people now feel that Roxbury Russet from 1635 is the true first named variety. But Blackson was a character, and he was described as sometimes riding through town on the back of a bull, and he would either toss flowers to passersby or apples, depending on the season.
Now, another very famous person in apple history, someone I didn't know came from New England, came from Massachusetts, was Johnny Appleseed, John Chapman. Tell us about him.
Chapman, I think, was a very amazing man who has not gotten the credit that he deserves through history. Many of the stories about Chapman are fictionalized accounts of his life, beginning with the tin mushpot hat, which many depict him wearing, for which there's no historical evidence. He was America's first great walker. He was born in Leominster, Massachusetts, in the eastern part of the state, and when he was six, his father remarried a woman from Longmeadow, Massachusetts, and that's where he grew up, near the Connecticut River. And when he was 23, he set out on foot for Pennsylvania. There's still no historical record at this point that he had anything to do with apples. We assume that maybe he had some experience with this fruit, but there's no evidence to support that. And he spent the better part of the next decade in Pennsylvania, living in the wilderness, and presumably this is where he gained his horticultural skills. And in the early 1800s, around 1806, he is setting out west. He collected seeds from cider mills in western Pennsylvania and took them west to Ohio initially, and later on in his life, Indiana. Those are the only two states where he is known to have planted orchards, although some 30 states claim that he planted orchards there. And he would set out mostly on foot, sometimes on horseback, occasionally by canoe, with his bags of seeds. And he would try to anticipate where the European settlers were migrating westward. And often this was near either a previous Indian settlement or near a body of water, a river confluence. And he would clear about 3 acres of land and use the brush to create a fence around it. And he would plant his seeds, and then he would periodically return to this area and tend the young saplings. And when they were a reasonable height and the settlers had arrived, he had a ready-made market for them, in part because of the apple's versatility and in part because, in many cases, land-grant companies required settlers to purchase apple trees as a good faith indicator that they were sincere about staying on the land and were not speculators. So he would sell the saplings for a few cents apiece and then move on to the next settlement. He wasn't the only person doing this, but he was far and away the most energetic, and he did it for about 40 years. And his real contribution to the spreading of the apple gene is that he accelerated the process of natural selection, because he would only choose the best seedlings. He was dealing in a climate and geography that was new to the apple, and by choosing only the best saplings, he really allowed the apple to progress westward at a much more rapid rate than it would have otherwise.
So you go even into his philosophy. He's a very interesting person from that point of view. You link him to Henry David Thoreau, although it doesn't seem that they ever met. I wonder if you could talk about his sensibilities, you know, his philosophy.
Yes, he was a Swedenborgian, Emanuel Swedenborg, the philosopher who developed, and theologian, who developed a whole cosmology of the universe. And his most famous follower was Ralph Waldo Emerson. And Thoreau, like Emerson, was a transcendentalist and very much had similar views that basically everything in nature is divine. And it's not just the people and the animals and the flowers, but it's also the rocks and the soil and so on. And the Swedenborg philosophy, it's pretty complicated. It's pretty sophisticated. And here was John Chapman out on the edge of civilization, Western civilization, promoting this. And it really made him kind of a marvel. He was physically unkempt. He was, in some respects, very Christ-like. He eschewed material comforts, and he wore very little clothing, and he stayed out in the wilderness. So he would show up occasionally in town at someone's house looking kind of like this wild man, but preaching this very sophisticated religion that came from Swedenborg. So he was kind of he created some ambivalence among his audience. And because he left no written record, we have to really speculate on how Chapman felt about apples. We assume because of his nickname, because of the years that he spent planting orchards, that he was passionate about this fruit, but we have no record of it. And even the stories about him have very little to do with apples. Thoreau, on the other hand, was very passionate about apples and wrote a very beautiful essay called Wild Apples. And he also writes about apples in his book Cape Cod, about his three walks on the length of the Cape. And what I suggest in this book is that Thoreau, in effect, gives language to what we believe Chapman felt based on Chapman's lifestyle. But we don't have Chapman's record for it. So, you know, it's kind of the effete Easterner Thoreau who gives voice to this guy in the wilderness.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Russell Stephen Powell about his beautiful book. It's called Apples of New England, A User's Guide. So talk a little bit about the history of New England apple orchards, you know, the kind of crop that they were to begin with, and then how they became commercialized.
Well, for the first century, from the 1600s into well into the 1700s, the apples were pretty much part of a typical small farm where people would have a few chickens, they'd grow their fruits and vegetables, and they'd have a little row of apple trees. And every household would make apple butter and apple sauce and cider. Cider was really the nation's main drink until about the 1850s. It was really only gradually in the 1800s that we began to see more and more grafted varieties coming over from Europe and created here in the States. And at that time, we began to see larger and larger orchards being planted, and there began to be an export market for apples. And we would ship apples in barrels from Maine and Boston to England in particular, but also the West Indies and other places. So there was a substantial market for our apples, and we also shipped them domestically to other parts of the Midwest and Northeast. But apples generally at that time were still part of a diversified farm. And it was only in the late 1800s and into the 1900s that farmers began to really specialize in just growing apples. And with the advent of refrigeration around the 1900s and the demise of the hard cider industry from pressure resulting from the temperance movement, the apple industry really had to reinvent itself and present apples as now primarily for fresh eating. And because of refrigeration, they could grow fewer varieties. Instead of having early ones that could be available as early as late July but didn't keep very well, and some that would be very hard throughout the winter or could be picked late into the fall, growers gradually were able to concentrate on fewer varieties that could be picked over a much shorter season. And the emphasis was no longer on strictly cider, but on fresh eating apples. And it was in 1904 that a man named John Stinson came up with the phrase, an apple a day will keep the doctor away. And that kind of signaled this big change in apple growing. At the time, New England was still a major player nationally. This was well before Washington State began producing much in the way of apples. So we were still a big supplier. And the big varieties around 1900 were all New England apples. Baldwin, which came from 1740 in Wilmington, Massachusetts. Rhode Island Greening, an even older apple from the 1600s, originating in Rhode Island. And Northern Spy, which the seeds for the Northern Spy came from an orchard in Salisbury, Connecticut. So we really were major players at the time, and that gradually shifted over the course of the 20th century as Washington gained prominence and was able to take advantage of much bigger spaces for growing apples and a better climate in many respects. And New England had to face some significant weather pressures. That's always an issue. It still is. For example, the Baldwin apple was almost wiped out in the winter of 1933-34 from a major freeze, and it has never fully recovered from that. So now we have varieties like McIntosh and Cortland and McCown and Empire that do very well in our soils and have been part of our landscape for a century or more in the cases of Cortland and McIntosh, and we're still, volume-wise, a small player nationally, but certainly within our region, apples continue to have a very large presence in our communities.
And it does seem that some varieties are coming back. I mean, I've been at the Brattleboro Food Co-op, and they have a broad range of varieties, many of which I've never heard of.
Well, what we are discovering over the past, say, 20 years, is that a lot of these, what we consider to be heirloom apples, have very good qualities, but they may have one flaw that prevents them from being a mass-produced apple across the nation. They may grow well only in New England soils, or even a portion of New England. They may be a great-tasting apple, but they don't grow to a very large size. Some apples have a russeted skin. It's kind of copper-colored with an almost light sandpapery feel. And marketers believe that consumers want strictly the bright red, the bright green, or the bright yellow apple. But some of these russeted apples, like Roxbury Russet, are delicious. They're some of the most flavorful apples out there. So I think what we're seeing is people realizing that there's a whole range of flavors and textures and colors available if they are willing to explore a little bit further. And with this, I think orchards have responded. And even our larger commercial orchards are now replanting some of these heirloom varieties. So while some of them may still be hard to find, if you're willing to search a little bit, you can find a lot of these. I think in addition to their food value, people are really fascinated by their unusual histories, and that was another reason that I chose to write the book. It's hard to think now that an apple could have been discovered in an urban community like Dedham, Massachusetts, but the Benoni apple was very popular for decades. And then we have unusual names like the Westfield Seat No Further from Westfield, Massachusetts. And I think that either the names or the stories or the locales for some of these apples really add substantially to their appeal. And you feel like you're taking a bite not just out of a piece of fruit, but out of a piece of our history.
There have been and continue to be some challenges to growing apples in New England and elsewhere. I remember the big Alar scare of 1989. And there was another E. coli scare in 1996, but let's take the Alar scare first.
Yeah, that was a major problem for the apple industry. Alar was identified as a possible cancer-causing agent. It was in the process of being eliminated from orchards, but in hindsight, I think that the industry responded too slowly. And as a result, there was a lot of publicity, negative publicity, led by Meryl Streep. And she appeared on a number of national television shows, beginning with 60 Minutes. She testified before Congress. And it really put a lot of growers out of business. The market for Red Delicious in particular just dropped in half in a period of about 6 months. And there's still a lot of, I think, residual resentment about this from the region's growers, since they were on the verge of phasing this out in the first place. But as I say, I think they have to take some responsibility for moving too slowly to make that happen. We are challenged in all parts of the country and in all parts of the agriculture with orchard pests and agricultural pests. And the problem is exacerbated in our current time as an unintended byproduct of global trade. It's almost impossible for us to inspect all of these big container ships that come in from all over the world. And we're seeing new bugs that we've never heard of before. And they are creating havoc, not just with apples, but with all kinds of fruits and vegetables. And it does pose a challenge. And the way growers have responded in the region is to use something called integrated pest management, which is a series of controls that are designed to improve the ecology of the orchard by strengthening the trees through nutrition and dealing with pests in some non-chemical ways, with the introduction of beneficial pests to eat the bad ones, the use of pheromones to trap or confuse the pests, and sophisticated weather monitoring and targeting of just particular blocks of the orchard that are affected rather than the whole orchard, and really setting economic thresholds that have to be met before any treatment is done. That there's no longer this idea that you can eliminate a certain pest, but what you try and do is keep its numbers beneath a certain level so that whatever economic damage results is not going to put the grower out of business.
We're talking with Russell Stephen Powell about his history and guidebook, Apples of New England.
Yeah, and then there was also the E. coli scare of 1996 had a huge impact on apple, on small apple growers. Connect the dots for us between that scare, which happened when there was contaminated juice from Odwalla, and that was out in California, and it may or may not have even been the apple juice, but it resulted in a big change in regulations.
It was very unfortunate for New England's cider producers because, as you say, the incident happened out on the West Coast, and it was about apple juice. It had nothing to do with New England growers or cider, but it was a serious incident. The Odwalla Juice Company took responsibility. It was around conditions at their plant, and they made changes, and they paid fines, and they did try and take responsibility. But it made people seriously concerned about the safety of the juice they were drinking. And what eventually came about was a series of regulations, including the fact that fresh cider now had to be pasteurized. And this was a very expensive proposition for a small producer, and it put a lot of the small growers out of the cider business here in New England. And to this day, there's still a lot of controversy around this. Some of the smaller cider pressers are still in business and are using some of these unusual heirloom varieties to make very interesting blends, but there are regulations about how they label that. It can only be sold on the farm. It can't be sold in the supermarket. So it really destroyed the market for cider fruit and limited the major producers to fewer varieties and the requirement that they pasteurize the cider.
And yet there does seem to be a kind of renaissance in apple ciders, hard ciders. Do these regulations apply to hard ciders? Because, I mean, isn't alcohol, kind of antibiotic?
Once you ferment the cider into hard cider, you no longer have that concern that you would have with fresh cider. And you are seeing some tremendous growth and variety in the hard cider market. You're seeing it at the high end with companies like Sam Adams coming out with their Angry Orchard or Harpoon Brewery in Boston and Vermont, or Woodchuck Cider that bottles six packs of cider, hard cider. These tend to be on the sweet side, and they're very different from some of the blends you have very small producers creating all over New England, and many people even just in their homes. It's relatively easy to make hard cider, and there are some astonishingly interesting blends now, some of them very dry, some of them a little sweeter. With this capacity to mix and match unusual varieties in a way that the big producers just can't do because they just don't have the volume.
Well, Russell Powell, before we go, I'd like to ask you, what's your favorite eating apple?
I get that question asked a lot, and I have to whittle it down to a few. I can't narrow it down to one. But when it comes to fresh eating apples, I have long been a fan of Macown, which is a cross between Macintosh and an old heirloom called Jersey Black. And Jersey Black gives Macown its distinctive wine red color and kind of a boxy shape. But it's got a very nice, crisp, sweet tart flavor. It's maybe a little more complex or spicy than Macintosh, but it's really a distinctive apple. I do love Macintosh, by the way. I love them both fresh, and I love them to cook with. Among the newer apples, my favorite would be Jonagold, which is an apple from 1968 developed in New York State. And it has for its parents the Golden Delicious and an old heirloom called Jonathan, which has a deep red color. So Jonagold has this light, explosive crispiness. It's very juicy, and it's sweeter than Macown, but has a little bit of that tartness. And the other one I would mention is an heirloom called Cox's Orange Pippin, which is still very popular in England, where it was developed in 1825. It's a gorgeous apple with nice red and orange striping, and it has very complex flavor. It's got hints of half a dozen different spices and flavors, and it's really an extraordinary apple. So I'll stop at those three, but I could certainly add more to the list.
Well, that's a great list, and I have to say Macown is one of my very favorites as well. I want to thank you so much, Russell Stephen Powell, for coming out with this book, Apples of New England, A User's Guide, and for talking with us here.
Well, thank you. And eat more apples.
Oh, you know, I want to ask you, is it true that an apple a day will keep the doctor away?
Well, they are very healthy. They're high in a number of vitamins. They have a lot of pectin. They have a number of antioxidants. So a number of studies have related them to having a beneficial effect in reducing cancer, several kinds of cancer rates. And they're fat-free, low-cal. They're even a great way to... there's an apple diet where if you want to lose weight, if you have an apple before your meal, you're going to eat less at that meal. And certainly, if you're in the mood for something sweet, an apple is a far better choice than most of the empty-calorie, sugar-filled snack foods that many people choose as an alternative.
Well, hear, hear to that. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Francesca. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Russell Stephen Powell. You can find links to his blogs, including those about his art and those about apples, by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.